So tomorrow night, we're going to gather and we're going to celebrate the life of Pete, the great Happy Traum. Will be leading us a very good friend of Pete's, a guy who collaborated with him and who Pete really loved. And today, in his honor, we'll be playing an hour-long interview that many of you have heard, but we can all stand to hear again next.
This is Alan Chartok, and I've talked to thousands of people over the years. Some of them are rich, some famous, some both. It almost always turns out that they are all just human beings with the same anxieties and uncertainties that plague us all. However, there are very few of us in this life that can say we've had the chance to meet our heroes. And that's just what happened one chilly March day this year when I got a chance to interview my hero, Pete Seeger, a man who wrote songs when songs had the power to move people. And there I was, negotiating the treacherous mountain goat road up to his house overlooking the Hudson River that he so loves. As I turned the corner into his long driveway, I saw him. He was hauling around huge buckets. He was using them to collect the maple sap that he and his wife Toshi would boil down into syrup. I entered the house to find a huge metal fireplace that they used for heat. Believe me when I tell you that they were burning whole unsplit logs in this contraption, and that Pete himself cut the wood and carried it inside. Once Pete was satisfied that he had finished his chores, we sat down and began a two-hour interview. It's an experience I'll never be able to replicate, so listen closely, and you just might hear that fire burning in the background or Pete and Toshi's dog barking from the next room. But whether you hear that or not, there will be no question that you're hearing an interview with a man whose music has touched the world. So sit back and get ready for Pete Seeger, A Life.
This is Pete Seeger, year 2001, in Beacon, New York, an interview for Alan Chartok.
Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear that music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing?
I'm really one of the luckiest human beings there ever was. I had an extraordinarily good education. My parents were split. I got a scholarship to a tiny little school, 50 students, up in Litchfield. It's no more in business, where I went for 5 years, from third grade to eighth grade. It got along on a shoestring, and the woman who paid the bills died, and the shoestring ran out. Then I got another scholarship to another school for 4 years, and I didn't know at that time the reason I got the scholarship was I ran a school newspaper, and the woman who paid the bills for that school liked my little paper. All she got from the headmaster were formal reports. And I, my little gossip sheet said, oh, Johnny Jackson is in the infirmary with mumps, and Mr. Sperry has started the maple syrup season, and the Eagles won the baseball game, and so on. And so she got the gossip of the news from my little newspaper. And that's why I wanted to be a journalist when I got out of, dropped out of college. I spent too much time on extracurricular activities. Actually, Arthur Kenoy and I started a little monthly called the Harvard Progressive. And it took so much time. I do the cartoons for it as well as do the writing. I did the calligraphy for the masthead and let my mark slip, and I lost my scholarship to Harvard, and so had to drop out in April, and tried to get a job as a journalist, but failed completely. Meanwhile, I had an aunt who taught school, and said, Peter, come sing some of your songs for my class. I can get $5 for you. Seemed to me like stealing to do what I'd done all my life for the fun of it. But I went and took the money, and quit looking for a regular job. I've been singing for kids in schools ever since.
Pete Seeger. Let me just try to do it this way. I'll say something to you, and then you say anything back that you want to. So let me start with Newspaper Man, and let that go to anything your mind may want to talk about having to do with media or politics or newspapers. Newspaper Man.
I learned that song 54 years ago from the man who wrote it, Vern Partlow, who was at that time, I guess, maybe 30 years old, and a working newspaper man in Los Angeles. A man who liked to write songs and the strum of guitar. An extraordinary man, really. He wrote a song for a friend of his who died after spending a lifetime as a rewrite man. never getting his own byline, always rewriting somebody else's stuff. He was only a poor rewrite man.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore.
Ding-a-ling-a-ling. And it had humor in it as well as sorrow, which in my mind makes a good song, because life is a mixture of humor and sorrow, and some of the best songs mix them up, like Woody Guthrie's songs did. He wrote "So Long, It's Been Good to Know You," about people having to leave their homes because of the dust storms. But he had "The Sweethearts Sat in the Dark and They Sparked. They Hugged and They Kissed in That Dusty Old Dark. They Sighed, They Cried, They Hugged and They Kissed. But instead of marriage, they was talking like this, honey, so long.
It's been good to know you, so long. It's been good to know you, so long. Been good to know you, the dusty old dust is getting my home. And I gotta be drifting along.
Does the media do its job? Is there such a thing as the media?
Of course not. It's hard for me to talk about the media without getting angry, because if the United States or the world goes down in disaster, I would blame the media first of all, because the people running it are intelligent people. They know very well how evil they are. And when they say, oh, I'm just giving the people what they want, sure, so do the drug pushers.
Is it a matter of who owns the media?
I suppose ownership is an important part of it, but it's only part of it. Nobody knows what to do about the pressure of the power of money. I've got one idea. You might turn it over. I think one of the best laws ever passed by the government was one saying that you should print on the outside of a food package what's in that food. So you can see what chemicals, for example, are in it, or how much sugar or salt in it. And if you're on a diet, you know to avoid that particular kind of food. Likewise, I think it would be a good idea to print on the outside of anything manufactured a little acronym, like the letter M for money, and the letter D for differential. It looked like MD. No, that would be confusing it with doctors. But it would give the difference in pay between what the executives get and what the people who work on the line get. Now, in some companies, especially family-owned businesses, where the whole family's working hard and they're hiring a few extra people, maybe the boss makes two or three times as much as the worker or the clerk who tends the counter of the store or the person who answers the telephone. But you know very well that that's the exception. The bigger the company gets, the higher the price the executives are, and often some of the biggest companies, like companies that make clothing that's manufactured in Asia and sold in New York for high prices, the people are being paid pennies over there, and the executives are paid thousands of dollars. So there could be a little one, like 1/3, or 1/100, or 1/1,000, or 1/10,000. And if you buy this article, say, gee, that company's not being very fair, are they? And you might decide not to buy it. If you have a choice, you'd pick another article, which might be about as good, but which has a better money differential. Needless to say, a law like this would be very hard to pass, because, as you know, money controls the legislatures of most of the world now, controls many small countries. However, I think it could be started if some companies would start doing this, like some companies have listed, this milk comes from cows that do not use these hormones. And people that would like to get milk that's more naturally made avoid that kind of milk. It's been fought by parts of the dairy industry, but other parts of the dairy industry said, hey, that's a logical thing. We'll support it. So let's take advantage of the arguments between the various people who control the industries and find if we can't get some of them to do some better things. And little by little, things spread. This is happening all around the world already now. You take advantage of the fact that no two people in the world agree, and quite often some very good things are done unexpectedly. Little things, bigger things. And I urge people not get into big arguments about words. Numbers are a little more reliable. Lord Kelvin, I think they named the refrigerator after him, once said, "You don't really know something until you can describe it in numbers." I hope you quote statistics occasionally. Even though most people are bored with statistics, that's just because we haven't found how to present them in an entertaining way. I once thought we should have a daily television program I was calling Pietro the Pie Man. Have a little short fellow with a good sense of humor, and he comes in with what looks like some pizza pies. But no, what he takes out are pie charts. And every day he's got a different statistic. Did you know that whereas females get the highest marks in such and such classes, men get the best jobs in that field? You could have amusing statistics and serious statistics, and people would realize that learning how to read statistics is a very important thing, and they don't all teach it enough in school.
Pete, let me just name a song and have you tell me what association comes to your head. If I had a hammer.
Well, I knew it was a good set of words when Lee Hayes sent them to me. Somebody told me that he says that we made it up at a meeting trying to figure how we were going to get some communists out of jail. But I don't remember that meeting. All I remember, I received it in the mail from him. He was living on the east side, I was living on the west side. And he says, "Pete, do you think you could put a tune to these verses?" And like an old gospel song, just one word changed in each verse. And I sat down at a piano, which I was living with my wife's relatives at the time. We couldn't afford an apartment. And they had a rent-controlled place with an extra room. So we were living there with our little baby. Come to think, we had two babies at that time, January 1949. But we were trying to find a place in the country to live because I didn't want to raise kids in the streets. I was raised in the country, and I persuaded my wife to leave all her friends in the city to come up and homestead on the side of this mountain. But in January 49, I sat down at my mother-in-law's piano and made up a little tune, wrote it down, put it on paper. The Weavers had just been formed, and we sang it around a little bit, and people liked it, and we even recorded it that summer for a tiny little company. I don't think it sold more than 1,000 copies. Lee used to joke, it was a collector's item. Nobody but collectors ever bought it. However, about 7 or 8 years later, three young people who had just gotten together changed my melody. And I guess in the opinion of most people, they improved it.
That's Peter, Paul, and Mary.
That song took off.
I had a hammer, I had a hammer in the morning, I had a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I had a hammer out of danger, I had a hammer out of warning, I had a hammer out of love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land.
Now it's been recorded by people all around the world. It's been translated. Sometimes the translations are screwy. In Italy, they had a hit record. If I had a hammer, I'd hit you on the head because you stole my man, you so-and-so. However, that song helps me pay my taxes every year now, thanks to the copyright law. And poor Lee Hayes is dead and gone, but he lived to see it become a very famous song. You never can tell.
You mentioned the beginning of the Weavers. The Almanac Singers came before the Weavers. How did that genesis take place from the Almanac Singers to the Weavers?
Millard Lampell, I always called him Mill Lampell, became quite a well-known screenwriter. But when I met him, he was writing articles for the New Republic about some homegrown fascists. But he was rooming with the most unusual man, this Lee Hayes, who'd been born and raised in Arkansas, but in the 1930s had been radicalized by the Depression. Heard about a thing called socialism. That's another word people don't agree on. Do you ever realize the post office is a socialist organization? Government pays for it. Hopefully it does a job for everybody. On the other hand, I tell my socialist friends, how is it not a single post office department in the world, east, west, north, south, invented Federal Express? It took one ambitious guy in Memphis to dream up the whole scheme. Don't post offices have research departments? No, they just do their job. Well, anyway, back to you almanac singers. Anyway, Lee Hayes had come to New York because he wanted to get a book of union songs printed. And somebody told me about it. I was trying to get a book of union songs printed, too. Woody Guthrie and I had worked on one. We had it mostly written. So I figured, let's go put our heads together so we don't just put out two half-good books. We might put up one good book.
Did he just come up and introduce himself?
I was given his address. Called him up. We made an appointment. I went and knocked on his door. And I also met his roommate, Mill Lampell. We started singing a few songs, and I realized Lee knew an awful lot about song leading and songwriting. And I was getting a few little jobs here and there, but I knew he was a much better singer and songwriter than I was. He didn't play an instrument, except he banged on the piano occasionally, but that's hard to carry along with you. I think we went and sang and got paid like $2.50 to sing at a little fundraising party for some left-wing cause at a restaurant, I think the Jade Mountain in Chinatown. And it worked so well. He was about 5 years older than I was and had vast experiences, which I didn't have. On the other hand, I knew some things he didn't know. And when we put our two heads together, we made a pretty good team. Pretty soon, Mill Lampell says, let me come along with you. I'd like to try making up some verses, too. And he proved a very quick verse writer. In a matter of seconds, he'd have a new verse for a song. So pretty soon, the three of us were singing together. And after about a month or two, we figured we should get a name. And I remember it quite clearly. I was reading through the introduction to the songbooks Woody Guthrie and I had put together called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People. Anyway, I'm leafing through Woody's introduction to this song, an introduction to that song, and another song, and I come across the word almanac. Lee Hayes was sprawled on another couch, and he says, hold on, Pete. Back where I come from, a farming family had two books in the house, if they were lucky. The Bible, to help them through the world hereafter, and an almanac to help them through this world. Now, we have an almanac of sorts. Of course, most congressmen can't read it. But why don't we call ourselves the Almanac Singers? And we told Mill about it. He turned it over in his mind. He said, sounds pretty good. So we were the Almanac Singers from then on.
How did it get transposed from the Almanac Singers? I once heard you say somewhere that it was the only group that used to rehearse on the stage while you were doing it, from the Almanac Singers into the Weavers.
Well, I'm a rather disorganized person, to say the least. And every time someone came along and said, can we join you? I'd say, sure, come along. Lee Hayes wasn't happy with this. When we had about seven people in the Almanacs, some 8 months later, he was saying, I'm sorry, I'm not feeling well. You go sing without me. And the rest of the group said to me, he said, Pete, you got to ask Lee to leave the group. He's just malingering. And so I asked him to leave, and he was terribly hurt because he and I had actually started the Almanacs. And years, decades later, I realized that he was deeply unsatisfied with the quality of the work we were doing, but didn't know how to say it. Lee was in many ways a genius. He wanted to do it right, or not at all. I suppose the genius wants to do it right, that is, my way. Whatever it was, Lee left, and then Millard Lampell got some writing jobs. He left. Woody got a job writing a book. He left. Woody had joined us about 6 months later after we started. And then I went in the Army, and there were some four almanacs, good people, in some way some of the best, did wonderful things during their lives. But they weren't able to make a living, and a few months later the group broke up. You might say the almanacs broke up because of World War II and the things changing all around. They went out to Detroit to try and work for the auto workers and suddenly found themselves in the midst of a terrible race riot. And union auto workers were involved in it. The racism right within the white Union people was more than they had realized. Well, after World War II, I'd been corresponding with Lee Hayes while I was in the Army and said, there's people like us all around the country who would like to use old songs to remind them of the old days and make up new songs to fit the new times. That's what we try to do with the almanacs, but we're kind of scattered now. Why don't we start a little newsletter? Even if it only has a circulation of 200, it'll reach people in California and Georgia and Chicago. And as soon as I got out of the Army, we got together and we had a meeting at my mother-in-law's place in Greenwich Village. And pretty soon we had another organization, People's Songs, Inc., nonprofit. Our first newsletter reached a few hundred. Our second reached many more hundred. Within a year, we had a circulation of all of 2,000. However, our dream of working with the unions didn't work out. The Cold War was on. They didn't want to have anything to do with lefties like me and Lee and Woody. And we went bankrupt in 1949. However, just about that time, Lee said, why don't we get another singing group together and this time do a little more rehearsing and have a definite group, try and get a job somewhere. At first, there were going to be three women and three men, but two of the women had jobs that moved to a different city, and so we ended up with one woman. But boy, her voice took the place of an army of women. Ronnie Gilbert, one of the greatest alto singers I've ever known in my life. A brilliant alto. Some altos are husky and raspy. Good, but Ronnie's was a brilliant alto. She could hold off the three of us men. We always sang with one microphone. I'd be 3 inches from the microphone, and Lee and Freddie would be 1 or 2 feet from the microphone. Ronnie could be 3 or 4 feet from the microphone, and she'd be heard above us, all three of us.
I know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who I love, and my dear knows who I'll marry.
Well, how did you find them? I mean, where did Fred Hellerman come from? Where did Ronnie Gilbert come from? How did these people get there?
Well, we met probably at the People's Songs Hootenannies. The word Hootenanny, Woody Guthrie and I had run to on the West Coast, and we brought it east. It's an old Midwestern term from Indiana, probably French in origin, Hootenanny. It was brought to the state of Washington by a Midwesterner. It meant about the same thing as wingding, an informal party. You know, what was going on at your house last night? Oh, we had a wingding. Well, it's like saying we had a hootenanny. Curiously enough, we had an early hootenanny at Cornell. There were some French students there. What? You're having a hootenanny? Well, what's wrong with that? Well, where I come from, that's when you shoo the bride and groom out into the fields to spend the first night.
So now you have the Weavers. You start. And what happened?
We were about to break up. We had not been able to get a job. We had a few evening concerts, but the Cold War really was taken over, and all sorts of beautiful hopes for rebuilding the Roosevelt coalition had been dashed. Truman took the safe way. You know, two of his cabinet members had a big disagreement. His Secretary of Commerce was Henry Wallace, who was a peacenik, and his Secretary of State was James Burns of South Carolina. And he was definitely not a peacenik. Burns said to Truman, you get rid of Wallace or I resign. Truman asked Wallace to leave. Truman wasn't as bad as some of the people around. There was a sizable proportion of the military-industrial complex that was convinced that World War III had to come, and the sooner the better. Ever hear of General Curtis LeMay?
Indeed.
I've Xeroxed and given away dozens of copies of a wonderful article in the New Yorker, June 19th, 1995, called The General in World War III. LeMay was in charge of the bombing of Japan, and after that he was in charge of Strategic Air Command and analyzing the problem of winning World War III, and that was his job. He was an expert military man. He decided the only way you could win World War III was to control the way it started. And here's how he figured it should start. He should fool the Soviet Union to trying to make a preemptive strike. And the moment one of their bombers crossed the borders heading west, he was prepared with 100 bombers to proceed going east and wipe out 100 Soviet cities and kill 100 million people and just incidentally poison the entire world. But that wasn't his concern. His job is to win a war. Ever hear the French definition of an expert? An expert is somebody who avoids all the little mistakes on the way to the big fallacy. Well, that's General LeMay. He died in 1990, still grumbling. We should have had World War III in 1954. Eisenhower had to slap him down. At the Bay of Pigs, he almost did it. And Kennedy had to slap him down.
So this is the backdrop for the Weavers now.
Well, Truman, as I say, wasn't as bad as these people. He didn't want to see war, but he didn't want to be accused of being a peacenik. That's how they wiped out Wallace when Wallace ran for president in 48. Oh, you're in favor of the Soviet Union if you want peace. And the media then did a lot of very bad things, as you know. You probably know better than I do. All I know is just my own worm's eye view.
So now the Weavers are together.
Oh, I didn't tell you the rest of the Weavers story. As a last resort, we got a job at a nightclub. I hate nightclubs. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I like to go to bed early. Around 9 o'clock, I see the clock says, I think I'll go to bed. However, I really wanted to sing with a group. Some of the best songs I know cannot be sung by one person, no matter how good a singer you are. You have to have one voice bouncing a melody back against another voice with a counter melody, as they say. In churches, they call it call and response. Oh, when the saints, oh, when the saints go marching in, go marching in. There's many kind of songs that need a group, and I wanted to sing with a group. So I went up to the Village Vanguard, a little hole in the wall, not much bigger than this room. I think they had a sign in the wall, maximum persons allowed 125. And the owner had once given me a job and paid me pretty well, $200 a week, which was high pay back in 1946. He says, Peter, I'll hire you, but I don't know who these other people are. I said, what if we're all willing to work for the same pay you were going to give me? He had to laugh. He said, if you really want a job that bad, okay, I'll try you. So we got a job for $200 a week for the four of us and free hamburgs. He came into the kitchen a couple weeks later and saw the size of the hamburgs I was cooking for the rest of the Weavers. Oh, he says, that's why I have such a high meat bill. He says, let's raise it to $250 a week, but no more free hamburgs. And he liked us, even though the audiences were not big. Sometimes we'd be singing to 5 or 10 people. In fact, I remember once there were 4 people there. We didn't sing at the microphone. We drew up some chairs around the same table where the people said, what do you want us to sing? We had a little party there. But in February, the crowd started picking up. We started singing there in December 49. And by March, the crowds were bigger. And he just kept to say, he says, more and more people are coming. You're getting good reviews. And in April, in comes a lovely man who said, I think you folks are the greatest I've ever heard. I work for Decca. I'm going to get you an audition at Decca Records. In those days, there were 3 big record companies, Decca, Victor, Columbia. They had 90% of the field sewed up. Well, we thought he was joking. I didn't know who he was. He said his name was Gordon Jenkins. I told this to somebody. Oh, he said, Jenkins, he's a famous band leader. Sure enough, there we were at Decca Records. The head of the company came in, Dave Capp. He took one look at me. He said, oh, I know these guys. They're not commercial. And he walked out, wouldn't even stay to listen to one song. So that was the end of our audition. But Jenkins whispered in my ear, he says, I'll get you on my next session. In other words, he had a band. No one could tell him who's going to be his vocalist. And he picked 2 of our best songs, very strongly contrasting. One, super fast. with a hand clap at the end. Lee Hayes used to raise his one hand high in the air and the other low down. Says, you ready? Senna, 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 senna. And on the other side, he put a languorous, sentimental old love song, which was the theme song of Hughie Leadbetter, better known as Leadbelly, king of the 12-string guitar, who had died way back in December 49. Well, Senna was going to be the hit side. Decca put its money behind it. Sure enough, it rose right away to number one. Then disc jockeys, just out of curiosity, played the other side, and it was the phenomena of the year 1950. Within 1 month, Goodnight Irene shot up the charts and took over number one. Senna Senna gradually faded down, but Irene stayed up number one, number one, number one, all through July, all through August, and finally in September it petered down. It was the biggest hit record, except for Bing Crosby's Sam song, since World War II.
Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams.
We were in a diner one day, and the jukebox was playing Good Night, Irene. And somebody in the diner says, turn that thing off. I've heard that song 50 times today. It really was on all the radios. And guess who was as surprised as we were? Not just Dave Capp, but the people who felt it was their patriotic duty to see that lousy commie traitors like us were kept off the air. How did we let those guys slip through our fingers, they said. And they started right out trying to see that we were kept off the air. We were offered a big nationwide contract, TV. We signed it. This big attack came out on us, and the contract was torn up. We got a few big jobs. Went to the Waldorf Astoria. Went out to Ciro's in Hollywood. We're on Milton Berle's show. He says, what's all this stuff about you not being patriots? I said, well, you know how politics are. Isn't it screwy? He says, yeah, it is. And Milton Berle loved it, so did Morton Downey, Steve Allen. I'll never forget Steve asking the four of us, how do you all get together? And we all started talking at once. I laughed and said, Mr. Allen, you better direct your question at one of us. Otherwise, you'll get all of us trying to answer your question. Well, he turned to me, he said, Mr. Seagate, how did you get together? I have to admire that kind of wit, quick on the uptake. He was a wonderful guy. I'm sorry when he died.
So tell me, how did it bust up? And tell us about the concert, Carnegie.
Well, the Weavers kept on going for about 3 or 4 months. But our manager said, I can't get the good jobs. I can just get the second-rate jobs. Incidentally, our manager wouldn't let us sing If I Had a Hammer. He says, Pete, I'm trying to get the blacklisters off your back. That just encourages them.
Who was the manager?
Pete Cameron. I don't know if he's alive or dead now. He was a pleasant enough fellow, but I found out later on he'd done some not completely honest things. He said, you're always writing songs, but it's inconvenient to list all four names. Why don't you take a fake name? This is standard music business practice. So he invented a name called Paul Campbell. And he said that represented the Weavers. He actually registered Paul Campbell in his name.
Whoa.
And to the day he died, he shared in the royalties. Well, he says, I was your manager. Well, I was sharing in your profits then. Why shouldn't I share in the future profits? But he didn't tell us. He at least should have told us. I found out since then we didn't have to adopt a pseudonym. Anyway, finally we were down to singing for Daffy's Bar and Grill on the outskirts of Cleveland. And we weren't making that much money, but when the money was split up four ways. So we took, as Lee says, we took a sabbatical, and it turned into a Mundical and a Tuesdical. And then we got a new manager. He's my age, Harold Leventhal, and he's still my manager. Wonderful man. And in 1955, he asked all four of us, would you be willing to have a reunion concert? Let's see what happens. The Blacklisters are not quite as important, as powerful as they were back 5 years ago. And he was right. Every year after the Korean War ended, America was a little more free a country. Seriously, ending that war made it possible to speak your mind a little more clearer. Our boys were no longer dying over there, fighting the communists. So Harold Leventhal went to town hall. They said, no, we can't have anything to do with the Weavers. We'll get attacked. He went to Carnegie. They said, if you got the money, we'll rent to you. He wasn't sure if he could fill it or not. But Harold Leventhal did a beautiful job of promotion. He wrote letters. He made telephone calls. And evening came, and Carnegie Hall had standing room only. Some people came around to hear us and found sold out. Oh, they said, we're so happy for you. Usually somebody who can't get a ticket is sad, but they said they were happy for us that we'd sold out in spite of the Blacklisters.
I thought I heard the captain say,
pay me my money down.
Tomorrow is our sailing day.
Pay me my money down. Oh, pay me, oh, pay me. Pay me my money down. Pay me or go to jail.
And it was recorded by a small recording company, Vanguard Records, which had a small hit, the Weavers reunion concert. All of a sudden, we're back in business. Trouble was, I was raising a family. I had three children by that time. And being a member of a quartet is like being a member of a family. So that in 1957, I resigned. Eric Darling took my place, a wonderful musician. Eric lives out in Arizona now. He's a good songwriter, good singer and arranger. Then Eric wanted to do more on his own, and he got Frank Hamilton. Frank's another good friend of mine. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia now. He then wanted to do more work on his own, and they got Bernie Krause. Then finally, the year of 1962, we had a reunion concert, and Eric, Frank, Bernie, and me all were on stage. It was a nice reunion concert. But Lee's health, which was never too good, was shaking, and the Weavers soon after disbanded. I think their last concert was in 62 or 63, maybe. And then we had a reunion concert of just the four original Weavers in 1980, just before Lee died. He was in a wheelchair with one leg off at the knee and another leg off at the ankle, I guess. And he used to say, us diabetics just get a little shorter every year. He was still making up songs, though. He sent me some words. He sent my wife these words. He and my wife both had a vegetable garden. He'd get out of his wheelchair and do a little weeding, and his neighbor helped him take care of it. He joked in the movie that was made. He says, when I was young, I was organizing sharecroppers. Now I have sharecroppers. Because his neighbor said, I'll help you grow that garden. I'll have a share of the vegetables.
You wrote a song about that in which you said, there goes Lee again.
Yep. If I should die before I wake. This is Lee wrote these words and he sent them to my wife. Now my voice is 95% gone, you'll realize. If I should die before I wake, all my bone and sinew take. Put me in the compost pile.
To decompose me for a while. Worms, water, sun will have their way, returning me to common clay. All that I am will feed the trees and little fishies in the seas. When radishes and corn you munch, you may be having me for lunch. And then excrete me with a grin, chortling, there goes Lee again.
Pete, are you surprised when one of your songs takes off? Is it unexpected? For example, Turn, 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 which has been re-recorded so many times.
I sure am surprised. I have never written a song trying to make a hit. I write a song because I want to write a good song, and I'm totally surprised when it suddenly starts selling, usually because a good singer has maybe changed it a little, or at least with a good voice, they've spread it. And in this particular case, Roger McGuinn changed my melody very slightly, but what he did was get a great arrangement with the birds, with these clanging electric guitars. They were like a lot of bells ringing, clang, clang, clang.
Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
They spread the song around the world. All I did was write the tune, you know. The words came out of the book of Ecclesiastes, sure, in the Old Testament. However, what I'd like to talk to you about during the next few minutes is an idea I have, and see what you think of it. I didn't realize until a few years ago what a common practice it is to take over an old song and change it a little, and then you copyright it and say you've arranged and adapted it. And the old song might have been in what they call public domain, and the recording company would not have to pay any royalties to someone singing the old song. But now it has slightly different words or slightly different melody, and now the recording company has to pay a standard royalty. It's like a little more than, I think, 7.55% pennies. A little more than 7.5 cents per record sold. So if you buy a CD with a certain copyrighted song on it, the owner of that copyright, the publisher, gets 7.5 cents. And if you sell 1 million copies, they get $75,000. And if some singer-songwriter rearranges a lot of old songs, they can make a good deal of profit if you have a best-selling record. Which I suppose is why a lot of people try and become songwriters. It's a gambler's life, frankly. You can spend your life trying to get a hit song and die saying, I failed. As I say, I found out that it's a very common practice to rewrite old songs and collect the money for it. And at first I felt a little angry about it. Then I realized I've done this all my life. I collected all the royalties for Turn, Turn, Turn. Rather, my publisher did. The publisher keeps 50% and he gives 50% to me. That's the standard publishing contract. But I didn't write the words. I was thinking I should send some of the money to the committee in London, which probably oversees the use of the King James Version of the Bible, that fantastic and wonderful translation done almost 400 years ago. It was the year 1607 that King James told a committee, make a better translation. But then I thought, maybe I should send the money to the part of the world where it was written. And I've did some research, and I found out it was 2,256 years ago that a man named Koheleth, that's his Hebrew name, meaning convoker, somebody who calls together a group of people to speak to them. The Greek word for that part of the Bible is Ecclesiastes, which means teacher. I guess that's similar. So much teaching is done with words. However, I think there's a lot of good teachers who don't teach with words. Anyway, back to the subject. I decided I'd send the money to that part of the world. But what part of Israel should I send it to? I found there's a wonderful committee there. Its English acronym is ICAD, Israeli Committee for Arab Home Defense. These are peaceniks who don't just make speeches, they don't just go on demonstrations. They're putting their bodies on the line, and they're going to Arab villages where army bulldozers are bulldozing homes and kicking people out of their homes. And they're going to this family, say, can we sit here in your home with you? We will not move. They've saved hundreds of homes. In effect, they're saying, you're going to either have to bulldoze us and kill us or arrest us.
And let me make this clear, these are Israelis.
These are Israeli Jews. And I'd like to help that little peace organization, so I'm sending half the money for Turn, Turn, Turn to this little organization in Israel. It's not a big organization.
But this is the genesis of a larger idea of yours about where this money should go.
Yeah. Take the song Wimaware. That's what reminded me of it. It was a hit song way back in 39 for a South African record company called Gallo, G-A-L-L-O, which was the main record company in South Africa, run by white folks, but sold records to black folks. And an African named Solomon Linda recorded this with four other young men called the Evening Birds. It was the biggest hit record they'd ever had. Near the end of the record, he improvised a little phrase, and on the Weavers record, I had better voice then, I copied this little improvisation of his. He never copyrighted it. Perhaps he never knew about copywriting anything. Perhaps Gallo simply copyrighted things. But when the Weavers had a hit record of the song, there was another publisher I work with, Howie Richmond, and Howie and his assistant, Al Brackman, said, who should I give this money to? I said, well, we didn't write it. It came from Africa. They said, do you want us to send the money to Gallo? I said, no, they won't give any of it to Solomon Linda. Get the money to Solomon Linda. So Al says, well, find his address. We'll send it to him. It took me 4 months. I found a Jewish lawyer in Johannesburg who'd been defending Africans in civil rights cases, and he took on the job and got acquainted with a lot of musicians, Hugh Masekela, the trumpet player, and others, and finally located Solomon Linda. He'd lost his voice. He probably sang the song too much without a mic. Gallo thought they were doing him a favor by paying him a couple pounds a week to work as a stock clerk. Just a routine job. He was no longer a star. He'd lost his voice. A Zulu, I believe. And this is an old Zulu song. And the words mean the lion is sleeping. Mbube means lion. And I guess we in front of it means the lion is sleeping. And they were singing Wimbube, Wimbube. But the B got softer and softer till it sounded to me like Wimbube. I sang Wimbube, even though the original was more Wimbube. Wimbube. And in the very beginning of the record, he shouts out some words in Zulu, which I did not know. I found out later they meant, you are a lion. You are a lion. And you know what that means? The original song was about King Shaka, who lived around 1830. He was a great chief, great king, great military leader. And when he died, killed, like most military leaders are, sooner or later, the legend sprang up, Shaka is not dead. He only went to sleep and will someday wake up. Well, this is the kind of legend that occurs when great leaders die all around the world. King Barbarossa, the Redbeard in Germany, they say, went into a cave and was sleeping and would someday wake up to lead his people again. It must be one of the more common stories that human beings tell. The great leader dies, but someday he'll come back to lead us. Well, I didn't know this. Except, I met the head of the Gallo Record Company about a year after our hit record, I think in 1951. I said, do Africans ever try and put political meanings in their songs? Oh, he says they try it all the time, but we weed it out. He didn't weed this out. This had a very political meaning for Africans. It looks like we shall overcome. Don't give up hope. King Shaka is maybe, you think he's dead, but his spirit is only sleeping. And that's what Solomon Linda was saying, you are a lion. You are a lion. The spirit of Shaka is in you, but you are sleeping.
What was it like when he got the money?
Well, they were trying to organize a union for South African artists, and a wonderful man named James Phillips arranged to have a big dinner party with 1,000 people there, and they gave a check for several $1,000 to Solomon Linda. And I thought from then on, Solomon Linda got all the royalties he was supposed to get. There was a muckraking article in Rolling Stone. Solomon Linda ended up getting like 25% of what he should have got. Indirectly, I got some of it because I was one of the technical, the Weavers were technical part owners of one of the record companies. However, that record company only gets a small amount from the song now because in the year 1991, a man named George David Weiss won a court case. He wrote 10 words, in the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. It was in the late 50s, I believe. The Tokens had a record. And I remember my publisher saying, Pete, is it all right if they sing the song with these words? We can stop it, you know. I said, oh, who's going to bother about it? They're kind of stupid words. But let them do it if they want to record it that way. We never realized that some 40 years later, 44 years later, something like that, George Weiss went to court, said, I wrote those 10 words. I deserve the royalties for this song. And if those 10 words are used, why, he takes all the royalties. None go to South Africa in any way. But I realize he did no more than I or a whole lot of others have done. There was an English lawyer who wrote some love song lyrics to an old Irish melody, which was published in the late 19th century, called Irish Traditional Airs. Beware that word traditional. It means it's up for grabs. It means it's public domain. That's the legal term. The copyright has run out. If there ever was any copyright, there's no copyright on it. Anybody can use that melody. And so the English lawyer took all the royalties for O Danny Boy, and none went to County Derry, Ireland, where a blind harper wrote it in the year 1603, when English soldiers conquered Castle Derry, and the harper was a distant kinsman of some of the people who were slaughtered when the castle fell, and he made up this melody in memory of his slain kinsman.
So your plan is that the monies that come from some of these traditional places should be returned to their places of origin?
Some. There'll always be arguments how much to send, but I think if you wrote new words, for example, for the song O Susanna, the Public Domain Commission of the United States could say, well, that song sold a lot of copies. You've got a lot of money there. 50% should go to the Stephen Foster Museum near Pittsburgh. They need to mend the roof and pay salaries.
Pete, you contributed at least some of the verses, as well as your specialty, which is popularization of certain tunes, to We Shall Overcome. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the royalties for this song, you'll be glad to know, go to a non-profit committee called the We Shall Overcome Fund. And every year they give away some thousands of dollars for the purpose of African-American music in the South. Bernice Reagan of Sweet Honey and the Rock is chairman of the committee, and there are some others, mostly down at the Highlander Center, which, because it was the Highlander Folk School that pressed the song around. It was Zilphia Horton at the Highlander Center who taught the song to me, and it was other people from Highland who taught it to Frank Hamilton, I mentioned him earlier, who taught it to Guy Carawan, a friend of his, and Guy Carawan was working at Highlander and had a workshop called Music in the Movement. And he taught them all We Shall Overcome, and they liked it, and they gave it this wonderful gospel beat, which Frank perhaps had, Guy perhaps had, but it certainly is the beat which they latched onto. It's called 12-8 time. Now, many songs have what they call 4-4 time. 1, 2, 3, 4. Dun, 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 dun. Slow songs as well as fast songs can have 4-4 time. But if you split up each one of those four beats to three short beats, da 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 da, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's what We Shall Overcome is. A lot of gospel songs have this 12-8 time, and that's the way Guy Carawan taught it to the Civil Rights Movement. He taught it to the founding convention of SNCC a month or two later, April 1960, and next thing, it was not a song, it was the song everywhere. Unfortunately, the woman who taught it to Highlander is long dead, and we didn't know her name until Bernice Regan did some real detective work. She went back to the Tobacco Workers Union in Charleston, South Carolina, where a woman named Lucille Simmons had taken a fast gospel song, I'll overcome, I'll overcome, I'll overcome someday. And she slowed it down. It's what they call long meter style in Southern churches. And she changed I to we. She had will overcome. We will overcome. She'd come out to the picket line. It was a strike in 1946. They said, oh, here's Lucille. Now we'll hear that song sung slower than anybody ever heard it sung. But it caught on with the other strikers, And at the Highlander Center, they learned it, and they spread it around the country, to me among others. And I had a Carnegie Hall concert and taught it to the whole audience. And the record was the one record of mine which came near to being a bestseller. I think it sold all of 500,000 copies. Most of my records sold 10,000 here, or if I was lucky, 20,000 there.
We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand someday. Deep in my heart,
listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.
We are not